Did you know the Bill of Rights has its own preamble? You're probably familiar with the preamble to the Constitution. Maybe you even memorized it in school. But most schools never teach that the Bill of Rights also has its own preamble. In a legal document, a preamble is like a statement of principles, but it doesn't carry any legal force. It's still extremely important because it reveals the purpose of the document and can guide us in our reading of it. Many of the states demanded a Bill of Rights be added to the Constitution as a condition of ratification. The first sentence of the first section of the preamble reiterates this point and states the reason for the proposed amendments. There are two important points to note here. First, the preamble gives no hint that the document is giving anybody rights. The rights were already assumed to exist. The amendments are a restriction on government powers that would infringe on those existing rights. Second, notice that the amendments were meant to restrict the powers delegated to the federal government by the Constitution. The second sentence of Section 1 tells us what ratification of the amendments was expected to do. Again, the first section of the preamble emphasizes that the Bill of Rights applies to the government established by the Constitution, that is, the federal government. This is extremely important, and maybe that's why government-run schools rarely teach about it. In all free states, the Constitution is fixed. A lot of people believe that the Constitution means what the Supreme Court tells us it means, until it changes its mind, of course. This is really the basis of what's known as living constitutionalism. That is, the political climate determines what the Constitution means, and that meaning can change as needed. People who support this view often claim it's required because an 18th century document needs to be updated to deal with modern times and issues. They even rightly say that the founders could never foresee everything we have to deal with today and in the future. But they conveniently ignore the fact that the Constitution included a mechanism to do just that. They also ignore the fact that the Constitution is a legal document. Can you imagine signing a contract for someone to manage part of a business, but giving them the power to unilaterally change that agreement without your input? No one in their right mind would agree to such a thing. The founders warned us that if the government could determine the extent of its own power, we shouldn't be surprised if that power would grow and grow and grow, no matter who's in charge. Samuel Adams put it this way. In all free states, the Constitution is fixed, and as the supreme legislative derives its power and authority from the Constitution, it cannot overleap the bounds of it without destroying its own foundation. Give government an inch, and they always take a mile, especially when it comes to war powers. Under the Constitution, Congress has the power to determine if the country will declare war and against whom. Only after that decision is made by Congress, the president takes charge of waging that war. James Madison put it this way, "The Constitution supposes what the history of all governments demonstrates, that the executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it. It is accordingly, with studied care, vested the question of war in the legislature." Hammering things home, Madison pointed out that the Constitution gave the president no authority to decide the question of whether or not the country would declare war. In the 18th century, to declare war was widely understood as making a decision to enter a war, This could be done with a printed or public statement, or it could be done in any number of other ways. John Adams said the mere act of arresting a person and taking them back to another country for a trial, without the permission of the home country, should be considered an act of war. Withdrawing from a treaty was also seen as evidence of an intent to wage war. For example, in 1787, the French regarded a British withdrawal from a naval treaty as a formal declaration of war. One leading scholar noted that the most forceful and unambiguous declaration of war was the commencement of general hostilities. A very typical founding-era dictionary definition of war was the exercise of violence under sovereign command against such as oppose. As the old saying goes, actions speak louder than words. Faced with these facts, many people today just twist definitions. For example, one common view is that limited airstrikes don't count as war. But under the Constitution, dropping a single bomb on another country over their opposition is an act of war. Twisting these definitions isn't just wrong, it has led to some pretty terrible results, too. Under George W. Bush's two terms in office, the military dropped over 70,000 bombs. Not to be outdone, Barack Obama raised that number to 100,000. And Donald Trump is putting those numbers to shame so far, with over 44,000 bombs dropped in just his first year in office, even though the country isn't supposedly at war with anyone. The lesson here should be straightforward. When you turn a blind eye to violations of constitutional limits, or you change definitions in the document to fit your own political goals, you shouldn't be surprised when politicians act like there are no limits at all. Some people want you to believe that Thomas Jefferson waged war on the Barbary pirates without congressional approval, but they're either ignorant or lying. Whenever we point out that the president is not constitutionally authorized to initiate offensive military action, we get a response like this. Thomas Jefferson sent ships and Marines to kick some pirate butt without even telling Congress, let alone get their approval. Are you saying Jefferson was wrong? But this isn't the whole story. In fact, it's missing so much, it's not even true. Aggression against U.S. shipping had been going on for decades. Barbary pirates captured a number of American sailors and demanded ransom soon after Jefferson took office. The president refused to pay. In response, the Pasha of Tripoli declared war on the United States. As historian Dave Benner wrote, Congress had previously authorized the Navy to take action and destroy Barbary pirate ships in order to protect American commerce. Even before the Pasha's declaration of war, Jefferson used this congressional authorization to send four ships to the area to maintain peace and even engage in diplomacy with the Barbary states. The commander of the small fleet was instructed to protect the ships and their crew from hostility by taking responsive action against the pirates. After the declaration of war, Jefferson remained steadfast in his pledge to demonstrate America's commitment in the matter, but refused to take offensive action against Tripoli, insisting that he was unauthorized by the Constitution, without the sanction of Congress, to go beyond the line of defense. In the following years, Congress passed at least 10 different statutes to authorize additional action. In 1802, Congress authorized the president to equip armed vessels to protect commerce and seamen in the Atlantic, the Mediterranean, and adjoining seas. Additionally, the president was empowered to subdue, seize, and make prize of all vessels, goods, and effects belonging to the Bay of Tripoli. Additional legislation in 1804 gave explicit support for warlike operations against the Regency of Tripoli or any other of the Barbary powers. But President Jefferson kept his word and always deferred to Congress in matters concerning the Barbary pirates. By doing so, he proved that American interests can be protected while still following the Constitution. The Supremacy Clause is clear. Federal acts are not always supreme. The run for the border. It's one of the classic plot lines in cops and robbers movies. Why do the bad guys always desperately try to get across that imaginary line? Well, it's because they realize that the police don't have any jurisdiction on the other side of the border. If you grasp this concept, then it's easy to understand federal supremacy in the Constitution. The federal government has certain powers, but it can only act within its sphere of authority. Once the feds cross that border into the realm of state powers, they don't have any authority at all. Alexander Hamilton explained this concept when arguing in favor of the Constitution in a paper called Federalist No. 33. He wrote, "It will not, I presume, have escaped observation that it expressly confines this supremacy to laws made pursuant to the Constitution." And what should be done with federal laws that aren't supreme? Hamilton, like other founders, told us just what to do. "These will be merely acts of usurpation and will deserve to be treated as such." A lot of people treat the Constitution like silly putty. If you've ever played with silly putty, you know you can stick it on newsprint and it will pick up a mirror image of the page. A lot of people think they can do the same thing with the Constitution. They stick it onto whatever political opinion they like and imagine the Constitution just picks it up. Then they pull on the edges to create new and interesting forms that were never approved by the people who gave it legal force. This is pretty much what people are doing when they claim the Constitution is living and breathing and was meant to just change with the times. Of course, this is nonsense. The Constitution is a legal document with a fixed meaning. The definitions of the words that make up the Constitution were not intended to change with the shifting sands of public or judicial opinions. And it's not a vague document at all. Like any legal document, it holds the same meaning today as it was understood to mean by the people who gave it legal force, that is, the ratifiers, the people of the several states. As James Madison said in a letter to Henry Lee, "What a metamorphosis would be produced in the code of law if all its ancient phraseology were to be taken in its modern sense." In other words, the legal meaning of the Constitution doesn't change, even when definitions of its words change over time.
When it enacts laws or regulations or rules or mandates that are outside the scope of its constitutionally delegated powers, you are not bound to obey them.
And the power which the states gave to the central government, they can take back. They can even nullify.
The Supremacy Clause only applies when it's a constitutional law. If it is not constitutional, then there is no supremacy.
I believe in nullification because the federal government simply cannot be trusted to limit itself. The federal government does not have the resources or manpower to enforce all its laws or regulatory programs. By refusing to participate, states can effectively bring many of these programs to an end. Presidential candidates want you to believe that foreign policy experience is a good thing. But American foreign policy is horrible, and it's the people with experience who have caused all the problems we're facing. Our goal is pretty straightforward: more liberty. And we believe the path is clear. That is the Constitution. Every issue, every time, no exceptions, no excuses. If supporting a presidential candidate is all you're doing for liberty, you've already lost. We the people need to learn how to exercise our rights no matter who's in the White House and whether the government wants us to or not.
We don't need no stinking permission. We don't need no stinking permission to exercise our rights. We need to exercise them whether they, the government, wants us to or not.
In fact, think about Thomas Jefferson's attitude toward the federal courts. His argument was the federal courts are part of the problem. I mean, you want me to go and refer my disputes to them? They're part of the problem. The problem is the federal government, and last I checked, the federal courts are part of the federal government.
Where I'm encouraged is that people are waking up. I think nullification is here to stay with us. States will eventually say, look, you've overstepped your bounds, and especially when the dollar won't work. That's when you're going to see the individual states tailing upon themselves to protect themselves.
So at the local level, some of the things that we can do is literally have our local elected officials not comply with the federal government. The federal government relies on local law enforcement, local elected officials, state elected officials to just go along with all these federal programs and sign these agreements. We don't have to do that. We cannot sign those agreements. We can actually get rid of those agreements. We can put in place a bulwark against what the federal government is trying to do to take away people's rights. And that is how we do it, one city at a time, one county at a time, one state at a time, by intentionally not going along and complying with the federal government and being their enforcement arm. That's what they have to use to enforce this stuff because they aren't big enough to do it on their own. So if local governments fight back, county governments fight back, state governments fight back, the federal government literally will not be able to enforce all of these unconstitutional programs and actions.
Let's talk to Shane in Michigan. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Mr. Binney, you mentioned that the NSA might come in with the National Guard to nationalize resources in Utah if that state turns off the water. And my question is, does this mean that the NSA is in fact reliant on resources that are provided at the state and local levels, and that if we can't get the Congress to do anything, this might be a last-ditch effort to put a chokehold on them and stop what they're doing?
I'm not normally for just standard civil disobedience, but and I agree with what Mr. Binney's saying in general, but the state triggering a constitutional crisis, blocking water, cutting off electricity, force the National Guard in to restore the water and the power, to draw attention to it. I think these are the type of stunts we need to start seeing be pulled.
Allison and Bill, if enough states do this, it will gut Obamacare. Because the federal government does not have the resources or the wherewithal. We know it doesn't have the wherewithal. They can't operate a website. But it doesn't even have the resources to go into each of the individual states if they start refusing.
So basically, the idea is this. So it comes down to the insight that the federal government cannot be expected to limit itself. You know, now I can understand somebody being skeptical of this in 1790. But, you know, we have a little bit of experience in this area now, and I think this is rather an understatement, if anything. So something outside itself has to do the limiting. It can't be the courts. Oh, the courts will put things right. Oh, let's everybody wait with bated breath to hear what our overlords have to say about what our Constitution means. Jefferson's view was that the Constitution was written in a way that the average person could understand it. You don't need some deep insight that you have to go into debt for 3 years to acquire. None of that. Just read the words. Read and also read what was said about them, what said about those words in the state ratifying conventions. And in fact, how has the leave it to the court strategy worked? Most of the time when the federal government gets away with something, it cites the Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause takes up about this much space in the Constitution. It takes up this much space in how the federal government justifies its activities. And in 60 years, starting in the 30s, going to the 1990s, the Supreme Court declared one federal law unconstitutional on Commerce Clause grounds, the Gun-Free School Zones Act of 1990. They combed everything. That was the only thing they could find the federal government had done wrong. So if you like a strategy where every 60 years your liberties might be protected, then by all means, don't listen to anything I have to say. Don't buy the nullification book. Don't do any of this. Or maybe twice if you're lucky, twice in 60 years. Now, it's just unlikely this is going to happen. And Jefferson and his followers believe that more likely was the outcome that whereby the federal courts would just rubber stamp what the rest of the federal government was doing. No surprise there. So what logically bears the responsibility of keeping the federal government in check? Well, the states. The states created the federal government. I go through all the steps of this in nullification. The states are the sentinels that will say, now, wait a minute, in this particular state, we're just not letting you do this. And this is really, it just boils down to common sense. It really is common sense. If the federal government is doing something that it's not authorized to do, you don't wait around fruitlessly for years hoping that somehow it'll change, because it doesn't. So we're going to try this. That's what it boils down to, the insight that the federal government cannot be allowed to have a monopoly on determining what its powers are. Now, I once explained to my 8-year-old, who was then 7, what the concept of nullification was. And I did that because she's 8 going on 58. She's like last year when she was 7, she read Little Women. Like the whole book. Like, this is not a normal kid in a good way. You know what I mean? She amazes me, and I know you're all sick of, oh, here's another father bragging about his kids. I'm sorry about that. But she really is unbelievable, and she blows me away constantly. But she wants to know what's in her daddy's books, right? She's read, look, I just read Little Women. How hard could nullification be? Come on. So she wants to know, and I keep saying to her, you know, you got to be a little bit older, and then maybe I think you could grasp it. And one night, she had just had it up to here with daddy's excuses, and she said, no, I want you to try. I want you to try to explain it. So I did. And I just went like this. So I explained to her about what the government is. And I said, so what they decided to do was that I thought it would be dangerous if these people could just do anything they wanted. So what they decided to do was to compile a list of things they could do. And I kid you not, she said, but what if they do something that's not on the list? I told you, she gets right to the heart of things. And I said, well, that's what nullification is. That's when the states say, now, wait a minute, that's not on the list, so we're not doing it. And she thought that seemed just and fair. So I thought, that makes her better than the whole Supreme Court.